Okay, so
Obvious, trivial.
did this week there's no homework, so I hope that you work on the quizzes. And actually, the priority of the quizzes is do the last two. This second week, there's the last two because that sets you background going forward. Especially, when we finally transit to part two. That's a part that you don't even need part one. It's completely, I wouldn't say completely independent. I'm always trying to draw a relationship between them. But if you just come to the class next Monday at the end, it's a fresh start. Okay? But of course, I hope you have all these things in mind and then compare and contrast. But this part is just, people wants to ask, what's the mathematical foundation of quantum field theory? So I'm trying to show that. Thank you. So also somebody asked about a gamma matrix in curved space. It's on Porto. And that paper has I don't know, it's a review of what Einstein does, but the point is read chapter 1, 2, and jump to 8. That's enough. There is what I don't know what's going on between. Just jump. That will give you the gamma matrices in curved space. You don't have to follow the order, so skip some pages if you want. Okay. So I'll start by, okay. So this has happened in some, I guess, private conversations during tutorials and this stuff. So I'll actually say yes. You're right. What we're doing is called inverse QFT. And a level zero understanding is that, see, this is the thing. What we're doing is called a QFT. We have quantum, and we build a field, and we study the theory. And what Dan told you is that at the best, the theory of the field quantized. So we're doing the QFT, he is doing the TFQ. Okay, I'll strengthen this claim about the inverse QFT next Monday. Okay, next Monday there is even further proof that yes, indeed, what we're doing is in inverse QFT. Okay, so I want to at this point, gather us together to see what exactly happened during the first five lectures, especially it's a Friday and we're 3 days away from the last lecture. I'll just draw some cartoons. So there is Dan having a state psi, and Robert, the cool boy, is on rocket. Sorry, Dan. And then says psi prime, and we spend like a 3.5 lecture. But finally, we solve the big questions. We know exactly how this is related to that with a little help with this girl called SU2. And she points us to us, says our fundamental state is something labeled with momentum, but that's not what she points out. But most important, it's labeled by the spin. And then they're back. So now here is Dan again, and looking at an interaction. And I don't know what to do with it. But Robert, the cool boy, says I can observe when time is infinity. Minus infinity. And says, ooh, this is what I see. There is interaction brought up to the all the way to the plus infinity. And then he says, look, maybe if I see, look at it here, why would there any be difference? So then we claim, this is the one we make the claim, is that where with a picture. Well, we're always in Heisenberg picture, but the point is free states are enough. And as we can see, that we want to calculate some scaling amplitude, but eventually the thing we have at the end is just some free states, and with all this time evolution operator in the middle, which you have already seen in the scalar QFT. And the next thing we see is this is scheduling amplitude. So I thought it would be good to convince that this thing I draw, the Feynman diagram I draw, actually come from something. So what I figure out is that. And yes, the color coding is one-to-one correspondence. I didn't mix match to trick you. So if you see a red line there, corresponding a red line here. Okay? So I hope. So the thing is, of course, what do you guys, so I want to say two more things about this, is that, of course, you guys point out, this comp cannot be corresponding a normal order. If it's normal ordered, then why would we switch them? That's correct. You would need an interaction that is not normal ordered to produce this loop. But on the other hand, I hope you still remember what Dan says, when you have this kind of loop, what do you do? You amputate. So in the end, of course, the normal ordered interaction will give the important thing. And the last thing I want to say is that, look, there is a 3 vertex interacting and the 4 vertex interacting. That's not because our interaction has evolved. That's because we happen to be in a theory that, in the words that Dan would say, that happen to have 2 interaction terms. I mean, who says this is impossible? Right? So you would be like picking this and then picking that, and you end up with something like that. Okay. So, but as I said already to some of you, this is a time you should feel a little unsettling. You have seen everything. You have a scattering amplitude. You have creation operator. There are states. They're not quantized. They're just states. They're just quantum states. Where does the field come from? Right? Why do we ever need a field? So I think the motivation of fields deserves a lot of more attention. So here is a play I write, a very short, between Professor Weinberg and a curious student. And with all due respect to Weinberg, this is completely, completely fictional. Okay? So at this point, Weinberg will say, so as you can see, I will be able to compute all the scheduling amplitude for any interaction. A curious student says, well, why do we need the fields then? Well, I don't know how to write down any specific interaction. Not any of them? Well, I can write for spin 1, 0 particles, but who cares about scalar particles? Me, I do. In general, my coefficients, all those CL keys, exist in principle. But in reality, okay, so I'll elaborate on the motivation now. So a big question. Remember we answered our big question. It's a big question because it always comes back. So this hopefully is not a surprise. And this is Weinberg's notation, which is pretty cool. It says if you have this and you want the 3 momentum, you can write it like that. Okay, so we found this. in tutorial one and homework one. Tutorial one, we showed SO3 is nothing but except SU2, and homework one showed showed the Poincaré group we needed. Yeah. So what is this? What kind of Lorentz transformation? Poincaré transformation will lead to this? Well, let's do this one first. Yeah? What kind of parameters? What I meant is, it's going to be U given some parameter here, parameter there. This one is normally the Lorentz transformation, and that is something. So what do you think those two entries?
Omega and epsilon.
Well, that's right. It's omega and epsilon, right? But I meant for if the operator is that, what a kind of, just look at this. What did we do? What a kind of a transformation is that? It's translation. And now tell me what happened in this. Well, that's remember the little group helps us, says yes, it will tell us rotation. But little group says that's enough. That it can be generalized to a generalized Lorentz transformation.
That's zero.
Because we didn't translate. And then I claim that's what it is. And the easiest way to look at it is actually look at the transformation. The transformation says, if you want to do a Poincaré transformation, you do this first and then shift. So you, from this state, you do this first and then shift. So that's the full expression for our big question's answer. And in tutorial two, what you realize is that I can have a creation operator and produce a state. Yeah? The whole tutorial is called a creation operator. So what I want to say is this thing is chosen to be Lorentz invariant. If I know how this transform, then I know how this transform. I don't want to write it down because it's not the most important equation ever. Yeah, it's clear? If this thing doesn't transform, then if I know how this transform, which is in this crazy way, I know this thing transform. Similar for annihilation operator, because you don't even have to think. It's the adjoint of the creation operator. Okay, now, well, according to one word, we're in trouble. This is some coefficient depends on all sorts of moment. We have some of these, some of this. And the biggest trouble about this transformation is about this momentum dependence. So it's not like a little group element I can conveniently combined with some other, because all this momentum dependence, which means all this A dagger and A, and they have all different momentum dependence, and think about how this crazy thing is going to transform. We can even think about the simplest case. We have a three vertex, two A dagger and A, and you have this amount of crap coming from one A dagger. And then it comes from the other A dagger. And then come from the A. You have all this huge amount of crap. And somehow you want to say, my coefficient is something nice. It is. It turned out to be nice because then you, in the field theory, you see that they are not so horrible. So this is Weinberg's motivation, says, well, A dagger and A really doesn't transform as I wanted, isn't it? Well, things are not good. So, I will say the first thing I want to say is be less ambitious. I will only deal with this thing. I know this thing doesn't transform well. I want something that it transforms well. That's basically what I want. So what should I do? I want to remind you what we used to do when these things happens. Okay? So previously in quantum episode, you've seen this kind of thing. You say XP are just not good enough. I'll turn it into AA dagger. The next thing you see is in group theory, you have J1 and J2. Somehow they are not good, while making to J plus minus. Yeah? So what should we do with this thing? That's right, what did we do here? What did this arrow represent?
Combinations.
One thing doesn't do good, another thing doesn't do good, infinite many of them doesn't do good. Maybe if you combine them, they'll serve something, right? So, since we're doing linear combination, then I'll write the following. Says we have a U, that's just what people call it, and then we have this. So in order to be the most general linear combination, because you know we don't know if we're going to succeed yet. The most general thing we can write down is with a coefficient. Depends on the spin that you sum over, the momentum you integrate over. That's the best we can do. But then, if we don't do anything else, there is a problem. Then we're left with a number. A number is probably no good, right? If you combine all your annihilation operator into an annihilation number, I mean, how is that gonna do any good if I want to write down a interaction? So you can see that we don't have much other ingredients, and that's how the locality creeps. It has to depend on something. Oh. This is not good. Okay, it's just cross. So, yeah.
We want to look at the transformation of A's.
Yeah.
But we can't do that for some reason. So
yeah. We're doing linear combination. Our goal. Okay. Sure. I don't have. Okay. Let me label it so we can talk about it. So this thing stands for mysterious, and that's the dependence. And the minus just means it's made out of the annihilation operator. And this thing we hope it transforms well.
What was your rationale behind saying that it's dependent on X?
Because it has to depend on anything, something. If you erase the X, it's going to be a number.
Because we're integrating a lot over p. And
yeah,
so.
Because we need to we have to be very cautious, and so there's some dependence here, some dependence here. So we should really sum over everything, because we have no idea if we're gonna succeed. And if you sum over everything, there's no dependence left. Yeah.
Really dumb question, but like, how come we couldn't say like define another momentum p1 and just only integrate over p but not over p1 and just have.
Well, that might not help us, right? Because remember, our argument about those things, transformation is no good, is because they depend on the momentum. We kind of want to get rid of them.
Why wasn't the transformation good?
There. and there.
Why is that an issue?
Well, but if you have three of these things, then try to combine them together. See if you can get something good. It's hard. It's a much harder problem. Two. So this is the proposal of one group. Is that so? Maybe let me well okay. Okay. Let me say one more thing and write down the transformation of this, and then we'll come back to questions.
Okay.
So this thing, still not general enough. And what if U is not like one function? It's many, right? Since it's a linear combination, so it has a label of L. So then I finished. And then here is the hope. Well, Weinberg probably knows he's going to succeed because he also played with the regular QFT. Here is the hope. The hope is that the hope is this mysterious field as big X and all curly, known as chi, will transform under Lorentz transformation with these being numbers. Of course, you see, if these depend on X, we're not gaining anything. So this is the hope. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Why we can't find transformation of A's?
We do. We have transformation of A's.
So then why do we need to write A's as a linear summation of others?
Because the reason for Weinberg gives is this is going to transform horribly, horrendously. This is going to transform horrendously. They will all transform in this horrendous way. And now I have to find a coefficient to undo all those transformations. I mean, you can find it, but you can't find a general one. You're like, write down three vertex, and you can spend a few pages to find that. And then you write down four vertex, you find spend another few pages to find that. That's going against Weinberg's claim is that he wants to do something for all interactions. And now it become a very specific job, and he has to make combination of all these things to talk to each other.
So the purpose of introducing integral P, which depends on...
Which these are just coefficients.
Yeah, so the purpose of doing this is that we know that this whole thing will transform easily compared to...
Yeah, that is the proposal. The proposal is according to Weinberg. Is that if you combine them in a very proper way, which is the U has to be very carefully cherry picking, then you might gain the advantage to end up with a thing. Now I can call it a field because it only depends on space time. The hope is if you pick U correctly, I can find this thing, such that the whole thing is that the field transform in some rep of Poincaré. I know, right? It's in a footnote. If you pick a lambda, it's not a rep. Like if you have the rep, then you have to follow this, the multiplication law has to be preserved. But apparently you have to take lambda inverse so that this thing happens.
This is true for active transformation.
What do you mean active?
We are not changing the coordinates, but we are physically changing the field itself.
Yeah, but if it's true for active transformation, it's probably going to be true for passive transformation. Just like it will have a different expression. So if pre-QFT, we would have no idea this is going to be true, right? It really crucially depends on how we pick all these coefficients.
Okay. If you said that U S L is only dependent on P and S.
Yeah.
You say that you're saying that it's just gonna become number after integration and summation.
Yeah, if you read X, it's gonna be a number.
It's not a number, but it's in the integral. It's gonna be a number after you take the integral.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was wrong with that?
Because this integral is what we call the linear combination. If you linear combination all your operators into a number, like it's just, well, that number is not going to transform.
Linear combination of all the annihilation operators.
Yeah.
What is wrong with that?
You needed this thing to transform nicely under Lorentz transformation. So yes, I got a new explanation. Lorentz transformation is about moving x to x prime. If your field doesn't even have anything like moving to x prime, why would you believe that it will transform nicely?
I think it would just commute with U's and just be...
Just be a number? Okay, so your theory is a bunch of number multiplying together. That's your interaction. That's not interacting. I think the biggest problem of doing that to turn this into a number is it's not interacting.
But if I say that it depends on a hidden parameter that is not locality...
Well, I don't know about hidden variable theories. I think you should ask Bindiya about hidden variable and the bell that we're going very far away from the QFT I know. Well, you can first assume there is a hidden variable. I know absolutely nothing about it, and somehow this transforms nicely. Or you can assume it's a variable we actually know. Let's see if it works. The thing I want to say now, so these are just really a bunch of numbers. The thing I really want to say now is, I hope you agree, is that what do you know? Okay. First, sorry, I'm going to introduce my notation, because do you know how many of this I have to copy paste when I write my second part of the book? Just think about it. So it's ridiculous amount. So here is a new notation. This thing is called the volume in this measure for the P. And because Dan picked our favorite, the best ever normalization, you can be comforted. You never have to worry about what's in it. Okay, you can just do two integrals. It will be happily, and it will plug. So the things that you can look forward to compute is something like this, and some A and C and A diagram, and you want to commute them. And this will exactly cancel out that, so you know that the answer is going to be only one integral, and you never have to worry about what's inside. Okay. So that's aside, but what can we do now, right? So if these fields are all transformed nicely, I invite you to look at our new proposal of the interaction. Okay. So of course you can introduce the creation field. It's the annihilation field, and then we have creation field. But the bottom line is, now you do a Lorentz transformation. It's a bunch of numbers. So this must be a bunch of numbers that are transformed nicely under Poincaré group to cancel that. And this is not incredibly hard. You have done this before. Their real name is called a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, right? Bunch of number, combined to be bunch of numbers. This we know how to do. Before, this P momentum dependent thing, it's probably doable. But you know, do you want to do it? So that's one Weinberg claim. Wow. This really feels good. Okay, so
I don't understand the.
Yeah.
How many?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. There's a bunch of number, 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 bunch of number. So maybe you have done how to turn a spin half state plus a spin one state into a three half and a one half. These are just saying we're making this standard.
But you're summing over there. There is no.
What am I? I'm summing. Yes, of course I'm summing. So sorry. This tutor thing is like before. It's a whole list of this. It's a number depends on all these different L's and all different L primes. I'm just saying this is in principle doable, and way easier than before because we only have numbers. Yeah.
I'm confused a bit. So if this H is a product of these guys.
Yeah, that's right. That's our Hamiltonian density.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. So that's Weinberger's claim. Well, you have to build a Hamiltonian density. That's what special relativity tells.
And the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient should just be E. I mean, we can guess that to be E because E A dagger A is the Hamiltonian.
What? E?
E K A dagger AK is the Hamiltonian
density. No, you are still in the A dagger A picture. Now we're in the field picture. So this one, at this point for you is lambda because the scalar doesn't transform, right?
So we can get lambda from Clebsch-Gordan coefficient of these guys?
Yeah, because for scalar, remember, scalar doesn't transform in the Lorentz transformation. The only thing is bunch of translation. You translate this way, you translate that way. And then you do some constraint, and you end up a number. So
you said it doesn't matter how many chi daggers and chi's you have.
No.
Apparently it does because you have just one term here being summed over with L prime and L.
Oh, okay. Here. Sorry. Okay. So the point here we want to make is that. Well, I'm not going to do it because it's in a footnote. It's not trivial. This is not trivial. So I'm going to do an extremely abbreviated notation because that serves my purpose. So I'll ignore all the summation or the index, whatever, but I say that the field is built with some linear coefficients and with an annihilation operator. So the thing I want you to really just believe it, because there's no point in seeing me do that calculation. That calculation is hard and doesn't get reveals more physics by doing it. But so believe it. I know how A transform. Yeah?
Sure.
Now I have assumed how chi transform, and we must know how you transform. It's slightly complicated. You have to do some integrals, it's the summations. It's not trivial, but it's doable. Because if you just look at the result, you wouldn't know why you don't want me to do it on the board. The result is. Not done yet. That's just the left hand side. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm writing this equation, I'm already feel this is crazy. But this answer is understandable. This is clearly how the. What? Okay, this is how field transform. And the other two is how the operator transform. Of course, they're reorganized a bit because the rest of my comment is going to be more interesting. And this S prime is summed over. And on this side, L is summed over. So at least index is right. So this is what we want to do. Remember, Weinberger wants to do as general as possible. This is the general thing. If you somehow solve this, what I call the equation of a field, you will get a field. Because the next thing is simple. You just plug in this, you got a field. And then you can see, this is definitely non-trivial to solve. But I want to enlighten you that this is somehow solvable. Okay, I want you to contemporarily forget about this crazy, ugly equation. And I invite you to think, how did we solve that problem? The big question is always coming. How did we solve that problem? Did we just jump in and try to solve this for arbitrary Poincaré transformation?
Yes, of course.
No. All right. Okay, well, I invite you to write a Mathematica file that speak this out for me, then I will be very, very happy. I'll be really happy. So what did we do? What's the first step?
Infinitesimal.
Little group
is not the first step. Little group is a harp. Like, little group is the harder part. What's the thing? Which transformation is the easy one?
Translation.
Shouldn't we use that be inspired by that and only considering translation? All right. So if we only consider translation, the left-hand side become B. And P, because lambda is delta. What about this term? Translation. What do you think a translation will do anything with the little group? It's an empty because it's translation. Okay, see? Things, what about this? Depends on lambda.
Identity.
So we're in a trivial representation of the Poincaré group, things get enormously easier. I'm just erasing some primes. That, okay, very good. So instead of that, we can just solve this. Yeah?
Is that dl prime l of w lambda?
No, it's just lambda because this part comes from the field. The field that doesn't know about the field that doesn't know about little group.
So if it's the general part, why is it?
No, it's the Lorentz. It's the Lorentz part.
So automatically, b is zero in the first line itself.
What? The b is not zero. B is some transformation. Oh, but this side, this side.
I could not understand.
Yeah. Wait. Sorry. This one. I somehow deleted the B. Sorry.
B is the translation point.
No, it's okay. This argument is the same as before, and this argument has been translated.
I'm kind of confused with that equation there. If lambda is equal to zero there.
Lambda is delta.
Sorry?
Delta. Identity. Identity.
It's dl prime l of lambda is delta when.
This one?
Prime L identity.
Because see, there is no B in there. This is an assumption. This is our assumption. The assumption is all the B dependence is in this.
So this is a rep of Lorentz and not Pomeroy.
Right, sure. Rep of Lorentz. That's right. Okay. Yeah, is this okay? Just all the D's become identity? And the lambda is delta? Now you get this.
Wait, Gong, I'm a little confused. Hold on, sorry. Can we backtrack? Why is D of like delta the identity?
It's the representation.
Representation
of a group, and then you choose the identity element of the group.
Oh, so it would just always be the goat map.
We always use identity to represent identity.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay.
Okay. All right. I think we should have a break. Well, after this. But what do you think the solution of this is? It's going to be an exponential, right? So the conclusion is that if you put the x plus b, and they would equal this. And I invite you to think. Where did you see this in dance course? Sorry, I didn't hear anything. I say I hear a lot of people saying things, so I didn't end up hearing anything. So, where did you see that?
Fourier transform.
So we were led to believe the mode expansion is a Fourier transform, which means, and what's the reason that it's a Fourier transform?
It's
because the equation of a motion of the field is p squared over m squared. Turn them into equations. that's the explanation of field. But Weinberg says I don't have an equation of motion. His goal is actually find a field and then find the equation of motion of the field. He will first find the solution and then give you the field equation. And so his explanation is because translation here. So we have that, but we don't have the equation for the field yet. So, well, I see we're pretty successful because before we claim this thing depends on both the space-time and the moment. And now the space-time dependence is solved. It's factorizable. So now we only need to worry about this. Yeah, we made one small step. We only need to make two more small steps. And we're getting closer to the end. Okay, let's take a break. So our today's goal is to end on something. End on something. It's a little better than this, which it doesn't look as ominous as that one. Okay, so far what we have done is, you know, a dagger doesn't transform well. We build a field, hopefully to transform well, but then we need to pick our U very carefully. And what we're trying to write is the equation for the U's so that we can solve and get us a field. Okay. So far, what we have done, you say, oh, translation is always the easy part of the Poincaré group. Why don't we just look at the translation? And we found that these U are guaranteed to be something like this as a exponential, but most importantly, that means that if we plug it back in where the field is, it kind of looks like our mode expansion, half mode expansion. And we say, wow, these particles has p squared equals m squared. Of course, we're doing special relativity. The next step, oh, okay. Next step, we did a translation.
Where'd you get p squared equals m squared from?
Your mode expansion has e to the minus ixp. Isn't that how you get how you get that from the normal scalar QFT?
What?
You solve your Klein-Gordon equation. You always assume your plane wave is a solution. And then you assume plane wave is a solution because p squared equals m squared.
Well, circular. What? You said the plane wave gives us the dispersion relation from the Klein-Gordon equation.
Yeah. Klein-Gordon
and
equation
gave. Because one is true, two is true.
I'm just saying that you are going to eventually get the same field that you study.
Which one was the assumption? The plane wave is always the solution, or the?
True.
But the Klein-Gordon equation is not necessarily true for everything.
Well, that's the point. That's why we don't have Klein-Gordon equation. I'm just saying, just by looking at this, it seems we're going to end up with Klein-Gordon equation anyway.
Oh.
Okay. So let me try to. Because this is really a special case, and we should look at it and then say, what make this case so easy? How come we just end up with this and recognize it's an exponential? And of course, what make it easy? If you turn those two horrible matrices into identity, right? So can we learn from this? A little bit. Well, we can't really learn from this side anymore because after study translation, we have to study Lorentz. The question is there any way we can get rid of that? Remember all the types of transformations we have involve translation and rotation and boost. And we've done translation. So the question is that which do we pick next? Our goal is to not deal with little group. If it turns into identity, so very good. So between boost and rotation, which do you think will keep us stay away from the little. Where did the little group come from? So we shall pick the other one.
Did it come? I mean, I thought it came from like lambda p equals p, and isn't lambda like
we come from to try to make this to be the same, right?
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the rotation part. You're right. Okay.
Okay. Very good. So what's next? The next is manage to get rid of that, get rid of the little group part, and I'll pick a special case, just like this case, that it doesn't have momentum, the rest of frame. If we're studying boost, I mean, it will be, we'll end up better to have the rest of frame rather than not, right? So, as we have discussed, that will kill the little group and give us, wait, killed. I'm just going to directly write down the result. It says, okay, let's see. Okay. Remember, this is a killed. That is still there. And this is the, so then there's no x dependence. And that exponential is absorbed by the translation. This is zero momentum. This is a finite moment. Also exceedingly easy.
Wait, so this comes from taking that equation, letting P be zero?
Taking this, plug in there, kill this thing.
When you kill that, you mean as...
Because one side will... If you plug this, sorry, not that side, wrong side, this side.
Plug that in there.
Then it will spit out something, which is on the left-hand side of that board, and this thing will cancel with that.
Is that because we're letting B be X and lambda P go to P because it's a little group transformation?
We are letting... Well, we're still... No, we're not letting anything be anything. I'm just saying if you take this equation, use the correct argument.
So correct arguments is like...
It's this. This is the correct argument.
Okay. So putting that into the... Okay.
So change the argument to make the correct argument. You'll get an expression, plug it in. You would see this will drop off. It had a better drop off because we already considered a translation. If B is still there, then we still have a translation.
Why does the ds prime s go to zero or go to one?
Which one, this one?
Ds prime s.
You're asking about this equation or that equation?
I'm asking about the top equation. So if we plug the bottom equation into the top equation, ds prime s.
Very good. It didn't, it doesn't. Well, it does because now we're considering boost. Boost is decoupled from little group. So their W is in identity for boosts.
Okay.
So that's our second little step. The second little step is telling us even the P dependence disappeared. If I know these coefficients at a zero, now I just bend with numbers. And I can use this representation to boost to somewhere I want.
Sorry, I didn't quite realize, but why lambda p is equal, did we assume that lambda the wp was identity?
Yes, because it's a boost.
What was w again?
W is something about a little group. The little group is something about rotation.
Yeah.
There is a very more rigorous proof to show you that w equals identity for boost. So it's in the lecture notes. If you're a little concerned about my argument, the boost means W equals identity, you can check it out. But I think the physical argument is boost is decoupled from rotation. Rotation gives you little group, then boost doesn't give you little group. So it's not that bad after all, right? Before you have something that depends on both the position and the momentum. But with the consideration of a translation, the position has dropped out. Well, it's not dropped out, but like we know the dependence. We're confident about the dependence. And with some consideration of boost, we know the we know that where we drop the momentum dependence too, says that it's okay. Who? Just bunch of numbers. If we solve this bunch of numbers, we're gonna boost it to get whatever it's at non-zero momentum. And after we get that, just add this exponential and we'll get the full dependence. Yeah? So from now on, we will only considering the this thing one that is a rotation, because that's the only thing left. Which means lambda is a rotation. We're considering somewhere momentum is zero, post rotation still have momentum equals zero.
Why is ULS, the argument of ULS zero? Why isn't it not P?
Because we pick it to be zero. I mean, you have to boost it from somewhere. And boosting from rest frame is the easiest to consider. So basically, so the question is, why do we do that?
Isn't P in the right-hand side and left-hand side the same thing? If you set one zero, the other one is also zero?
No, this one is P. This one is after doing Lorentz transformation to the P where you are.
But the little group transformation. Left.
There's no little group. We consider the boost.
Oh, right.
So far, we have done our best effort to stay away from little group. In nowhere, we want to get into this little group business. Okay, so then in this case, the claim is that the result should be this. If you only consider rotation, translation disappeared. And this P is set to be zero. Okay, that needs a little digest. So this disappeared because of translation. And this has been set at momentum zero. And that we didn't do anything. And this on this side, again, the momentum is set to zero because we're doing a rotation. And the P, B doesn't exist because when we're doing translation, all disappear.
Why does lambda x disappear?
Because anything related to x would disappear. Because when you put the lambda x here, you'll have lambda x dot p, and then you have a x dot lambda p. So that's actually exactly how this term is. So in the end, we get this. This is from the field, and this is from the little group. Like we have nothing, we can't do anything except to consider that the little group actually contributes something, which is a good thing. So the next step I do is to linear expand and consider the generators.
So the next thing I do is say D is the representation to always equals to 1 plus I epsilon T. T is a generator. So instead of writing the one for the representation, I can write one for the generators. Things gets to sum. So, okay, so this is very fast from this gigantic, enormous equation down to this thing. So if you really want to follow, how do I get here from that thing, then I suggest you read some of the derivation that I skipped. I'll just say I have motivation to do this, and here's the result. I have motivation to do that, here's the result. So this part is hard. It does cost me a lot of trouble to fill in that red derivations when I was reading. But then it's all in lecture notes, how precisely starting even earlier. So the starting point is A transform in some way, field transform in some way, then you must transform some way to make this thing work. Starting point is this, and the transformation of A and the chi minus, and the end point is here. So I suggest you to actually follow the notes, do some derivation to follow where they're. It's tough. Maybe I should have start this lecture that this is the toughest lecture, because all this derivation. But I thought even if I fill all the derivation step on the board, it wouldn't help, because you are watching me do the derivation. So I just want to give you the highlight that because of this, we can find a U. And then there were several lines to tell you U is actually this. Okay, this one is actually. But the boost, you can actually very seriously to argue why for the little group boost is identity. Like, well, the little group become identity. And they are all very rigorous, serious derivation behind them. But this is our bottom line. The bottom line is we get here and there's nothing we can do. We used all our generators, translation, boost, rotation. From this onward, we have to go specific. This is keeping everything general. This is as far as we can push. What it tells us is an equation of these bunch of numbers. We just need to, because generators are just bunch of numbers, remember? You saw generators, they're just nothing but a polymatrix. They are nothing but some 3x3 adjoint rep. They're numbers. It's like a numbers times numbers. Well, more like a sort of a matrix thing, but they are numbers. They are all numbers. And what I want to point it out is this actually comes from the little group. One that the rotation is the little group. And what do you think these are? These are the generators of the little group with rotation. Yeah, but I circled an S.
Spin.
Look at this thing. We know this thing. These are not just a bunch of numbers. They are the known numbers. Like theoretically, we know these numbers up to j goes to infinity. It's not going to be pretty at, 20 or 56. But we know them, yeah. This is our SU2 rep. And it screams for SU2, and it is. So what is SU2? Tells us about. If you have a SU2, if you know you are living in the J rep of SU2, what do you know?
know how to represent any of the representations because we wrote.
That's right. But physically, if I give you a particle, I said it's represented in SU2 with J.
It's a half integer spin.
Precisely, what's that spin?
One.
No?
J.
J. Just J, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Remember that letter? This is J. This is minus J. So this is crazy, because let's just look at what are these. Maybe you find this thing very alien. Maybe not. Not would be better. But this you have computed. You have, at least you have computed one of them. Oh, very good. I even have. Remember you computed one of them? And that one tells us this, right? Yeah, what are they? What did you compute to get that? Tutorial 3, what did you compute? That's right, but what are they?
That's right.
What do you call the commutator of gamma? Okay, very good. Who knows what's. Okay, what is this though? Remember, there is the slightly lengthy part of tutorial, maybe even more lengthy than slightly lengthy. But I was asking that this thing you computed with gamma matrix, what do they form?
Rotation matrices.
They're rotation matrices for the spinner. So I only use an example. When L is taken some number such that this is the rotation matrix of spinner. But now you know, given a rep of the Lorentz group, you should always be able to compute the rotation generator.
Wait, were you saying that J is our rotation? The J's are our rotation matrices for the spinner, or were you saying the gammas were?
J. J is the generator.
The generator. But then if J is the generator.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's
for rep L.
Yeah, but it's the generator of rotations, right? It's not the full blown rotation matrix.
Oh no, no, it's just the generator.
Okay.
So D is the full thing? And now we're just going to linear expand and look at the vicinity of identity and turn them into generators. Actually, from this line to this line, did actually absolutely nothing except to replace D with J. Right? This line is identical to that line, except I replaced the D with J because they are both 1 plus epsilon J in both cases. Okay, so the final thing I want to say is now it's clear how we're going to move forward, right? Take L. L tells you some rep. Take rep L. And then there's some numbers I pick. You just need to figure out which numbers has to be picked in this way, such that this equation is satisfied. Then you immediately come to the conclusion. This has a spin J. It's very powerful. Gave me a Lorentz representation, I'll immediately able to tell you what a spin particle it describes. Okay, so yeah.
In the equation over there, you have a J on the LHS. So you have a J on the LHS in the main equation.
This J?
Yes. So we are already in a particular representation. In the RHS, we don't have any.
No, like at this point, at this point, we don't know what J is. Like J is general. We just know it's going to be some J because it comes from that.
But the representation on LHS should be equal to representation on RHS.
What?
Like, whatever rep we choose on the left hand side should also be the rep on the right hand side.
Yeah, but then you are saying I assume it's a spin S spin S particle, then we'll try to look for what a rep it's using. That's also fine. Yeah, that's fine. You can go back and forth. You say, I assume it's a spin J particle and I'm going to look for a rep. That turns out just be harder.
And why do you say that picking L is equivalent to picking a big rep?
No, I'm not saying it's equivalent. I'm just saying if I pick an L, I pick the right hand side, then there's only one rep is going to make this matrix equation work. Only one particular E rep that has spin J will make this work. That we're going to do this for two cases on Monday, which is a scalar and a field. Well, I can, sure. If you wanted me to do the scalar, scalar is simple, right? Because we can go back to this and scalar its identity. And then we get to that ULS0 equals ULS0. No information, but this tells us there's no constraint. It's just a number. If you want to actually constrain that number, then we have to use some other things. So far, we only used the one requirement from relativity, which is you need to transform well. Remember, there is also the causality. When you impose causality, then you will be learning something else. I'll come back to this point. So now, yeah, almost immediately. But the first, I want to make comments about the thing we have done. The first comment is that if you have a field, then you are guaranteed to not violate a cluster decomposition principle. Because you just have something e to the minus ixp, e to the minus ixp1. It's just a bunch of e to the minus ix something. And then you do the integral over x, the delta comes up. There's not going to give you another delta. So this class is automatically satisfied as you have learned in scalar QFT. Is that your vertex is always going to give you a momentum conservation at the vertex. And the second comment, which is actually what you asked, is that if this thing I just bunch of a number, it's just like any number, are we done? Well, not quite. There is one problem. The problem is that if you compute this, it's not zero at the space like. It's just not zero. And well, the very funny, how do we make it zero? What could we do? The technique that we already used. Time ordering is not helping because time ordering tells that as this has to be zero. It's the lesser, remember this is called the creation field. This is the annihilation field, and you know that from dense QFT, scalar field works.
You make a linear combination?
It's perfect, right? You make a linear combination. And now you can require this thing will actually vanish at a space like.
Commutative phi with phi itself.
Which is what you computed in QFT. Is you computed a phi and a phi. You're like, whoa, this vanished at a space like. And okay, here is the there is a problem with making a linear composition. So the problem is I have a charge operator. I have no idea what kind of charge it is. But this is what we meant, that it has a charge. I make one particle state, and I use my charge operator and known charge operator to measure, and it gave me an eigenvalue. And what you can show from this is that it has this two equation, says that the commutator between Q and A dagger and the commutator with Q with A is not going to be the same, because A dagger means you create a charge. A means you lose a charge. They can't be the same. But then we also want to make a claim says that I make a field and that this field somehow has definite a charge. That's certainly not going to happen. If Q, A dagger, produce a charge, A produce a negative charge, there's no way the field is going to have a definite commutator relationship. That's what Weinberg says. See, if you want to something like this. Okay, this is the chi field. It's made with U with A dagger and some other coefficients, V with A. And there's a problem. If there is a charge, this field is going to be very frustrated. So the only way to be not frustrated is to introduce. So particle carries plus charge. Then that's great. That's what Weinberg says. Well, that's the reason antiparticle must exist. So I'm going to erase. Sorry. U normally is a dagger. The point is, you have to introduce a different creation operator to make the particle that have exactly the opposite charge. So using annihilation operator to decrease some charge, it's like creating the antiparticle that which carries the negative. That's the only way to make this combination. Remember, we have to make this linear combination, otherwise causality is violated. And the argument is, as soon as you say, I have to make the linear combination, we have to have antiparticle, unless your charge is zero. If your charge is non-zero, you have to have antiparticles to go with it.
Okay, so how can we need like the commutator to give us the same charge for the different creation and annihilation operator?
If A is the adjoint of A dagger, you just take the adjoint of this equation, you will get that equation. Because then you look at the field, because you want to linear you want to make it this. And one of these things says after commute with this charge, your charge go up, the other one says charge go down.
So it wouldn't change the charge?
Not really. It just means this is not nice.
What does it end up being? It doesn't give you Q times the field?
And it gave you Q this and a Q that.
Oh, and we don't have like a single...
We don't really have a conserved charge.
We assume that there's some kind of charge.
If you assume there's any kind of a charge, then antiparticle must exist.
And if there's no charge, then...
That's fine. If you have no charge, that's what you learned in your scalar QFT, right? Scalar QFT doesn't need to introduce anything more. You just have a dagger, then you're done.
But
but you have also done the complex scalar CFT, then you need different things. You need two sets of A dagger. Like you need A dagger A, and then you need A dagger B. Then once you go to complex, you're in trouble. Scalar, no problem. Like a real scalar, no problem.
I don't understand what the problem is, to be honest.
Okay, so...
Sorry, I don't understand what the problem is. So that is a linear combination of two operators.
If you want to claim Q is a charge, you must have this. Otherwise, it's not a charge. And this is made of a bunch of that. Right? I mean, this is the definition that Q is a conjugate of the charge. And if your Hamiltonian is made of all this field that gave you crap, you might be end up with crap instead of this.
How do we know that that's, so to speak, crap?
It's not zero.
But couldn't other terms, different terms, cancel each other?
You can work out an example if it works.
Please show it to me.
Okay. I can't show it to one bird, very sadly. But I would like to see. Yes, I'm going to say the glasses over, and if you want to go to Lewis, then you should go.